This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international programme of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hi, everyone at home, and welcome. This is To the Journey. I'm your co-host, Kay Shaw, and with me, as always, are...
Suzanne Williamson and...
Zachary Fruling.
Well, tonight we have an episode that was actually a request from our listener, Justin, who's also now our content manager on the network. And he asked if we would do an episode about the character Lon Suda, which I think was a really interesting request, and we were all quite psyched up about tackling this one. So, first thoughts on Lon Suda, everyone.
Amazing. Great actor. Brad Dourif. Love him in everything he's ever done.
Yeah, he's incredible.
I really love the episode Meld. It's not quite a murder mystery, but it's kind of like Murder on the Delta Quadrant Express.
Ba-dow-bow. Thank you, Zachary Christie.
I think we reveal the killer a little bit early, though, don't we?
I do. I would have dragged out the mystery a little bit.
I guess, but then I think it's mostly supposed to be about Tuvok, isn't it, really?
Well, if you dragged out the mystery, then you wouldn't have as much Brad Dourif as you have, which for me would be
true.
A letdown, because he's awesome. I mean, come on, he's the voice of Chucky. You can't get creepier than that. Chucky.
And he's in Lord of the Rings.
Uh-huh.
He is, yeah. Aside from this, the most thing that I remember him from is Lord of the Rings, yeah.
I actually didn't remember that until you guys pointed it out. And I'm like, what, the light bulb went on? Oh, yeah.
He was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Dune. He was in one of my favorite TV shows, Deadwood.
Oh, gosh, yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. He was great in Deadwood.
I've forgotten that as well. Mm, yeah.
I see where you guys are going. Let's talk about more movies Zach hasn't seen.
Oh, we'd be here all night, Zach. We don't have time for that. Yeah, neither do the listeners.
No.
Seriously, though, I love the character of Lon Suda. He's such he has this quiet intensity about him that is really creepy, especially when you combine it with those black Betazoid contact lenses that he's wearing.
Oh, yeah.
He's got this really creepy, but he's not overstated. He's not scary. He's just kind of quiet and intense.
Definitely. And he's not like any other Betazoid we've ever met, because he's not empathic. He's just completely different. Totally out there.
There's something really scary about a telepathic sociopath.
Mm. But is he really telepathic?
He's Betazoid.
That doesn't mean that he's automatically telepathic, because he's not empathetic.
Is that
either.
True? Are some Betazoids not telepathic? He's not. He doesn't have a lot of empathy, that's for sure.
He says that he can't feel other people's emotions, doesn't he? But we don't really hear him talk about telepathy. I don't know whether they dropped the whole telepathy idea by now because they realized it broke all their plots, but anyway.
Or it just could be that the mental illness that he has impairs those things in his Betazoid physiology.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we don't know whether or not some sort of traumatic events happened to him in his past that's caused this. That's what I always wondered about, maybe. Yeah.
He was on a ship once with Dr. Crusher, and she was busy treating someone with skin, knees, and elbows, and he lost his empathic sense. That's how he got where he is now.
Don't blame Dr. Crusher.
No.
Leave my Beverly alone.
Why? Counselor Troy did.
Yeah, fighting talk. But no, I mean, we see... I know you say that, oh, he's not really like any other Betazoid that we see, and I agree with that. But we do see other Betazoids suffering from problems that are caused as a result of things that have happened to them. Like the whole thing with Luxana Troy with the other daughter that died. Mm-hmm. You know, she gets a lot of mental issues. And I wonder whether or not with the telepathy and empathy and everything, they're very prone to mental breakdown in that way.
Could be.
It would certainly make sense.
I would think it would be overwhelming. I'd get annoyed just listening to people on the way to the pharmacy, much less you know, having to put up with people's thoughts all the time.
Out. Just like Jean Grey, you know, and Professor X, they gotta learn to tune them out.
We don't really find out a lot about his history, though, do we, at all? I mean, he says that he's always had these feelings. I think that's pretty much all we know about his past. Oh, and he says that he's tried to hide them from his family.
Yeah, other than
but
that...
But aside from that, we don't hear a lot about it, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, so who knows? Who knows? Maybe something happened in his past that's caused these problems, I don't know. But those eyes, I agree. They're like, it's like looking into the abyss, isn't it?
Yeah. Like shark's eyes.
I think Tuvok's position is really interesting because there's a sense in which people who aren't murderous, people who aren't criminals, people who don't always have bad intentions, they can't understand people who are like that. And Tuvok is in that position where he's like desperately wants to understand and make it rational what Suter is doing, and it's just not making sense. And I think all of us are like that. We don't understand people who are more on the Suter side of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely struggle to get inside the heads of people who do stuff like that.
I mean, I was on a jury once for a murder trial for like 6 weeks, and it was really intense. It was actually remarkably more traumatic than you might think it would be. But I was kind of felt like Tuvok, like you just want to like understand what could possibly go wrong with someone's mind and make them like that. I can understand how Tuvok could really be bothered by this.
I've wanted to be on jury duty forever, and they never call me.
Yeah, I kind of think it would be a cool thing to do, but I guess it depends on what you get to preside over effectively, because some of it can be pretty awful.
Yeah,
it was awful. I mean, I saw things I'll just never forget, and I got kind of like Tuvok. I was kind of obsessing over it. Like, it just was always on my mind. It didn't make sense. I was disturbed by it, and it, you know, it really kind of affected me.
So yeah. You were like Henry Fonda in 12 Angry Men. That was you.
Yeah, okay. Totally. Except we found the guy guilty.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, but he wouldn't let it go either.
Well, totally let it go. He just walked out the door at the end of the trial. He didn't care. He didn't know any of the people involved. He didn't care.
Yeah.
Walking down the steps of the courthouse at the end of the movie, put his hat on, he's out
the
door.
Well, he shook hands with a couple of people.
That's true.
Like Jack Klugman, I think, was one of them.
But I think it's interesting, though, because Tuvok doesn't usually obsess over stuff too much, and he really obsesses over Suter.
Yeah, he does. And I think, as we've seen before, you know, I know logic is a big thing for Vulcans, mm-hmm. but it's a really huge thing in particular for Tuvok, because I think he's more Vulcan than other Vulcans we see in Star Trek. And I know we've said this before, but, you know, he just can't function. It's almost like a sort of error when he can't come up with a logical reason for an event. It's almost like his brain's like error messaging out on him. It's like, wah, does not compute.
That could be a Vulcan mental issue.
Yeah.
So
oh,
we could possibly have two different species with mental issues going on in this episode. One is obsessive compulsive, the other is sociopathic.
Well, there's a sense in which Tuvok can just not understand something as simple. I mean, Suter's explanation for what happened is really interesting. He says, I didn't like the way he looked at me. And that kind of stuff happens. Mm-hmm. People do kill people because they didn't like the way I mean, you hear stories about people shooting each other on the street or in the car or whatever. And it's like, well, that just fundamentally doesn't make sense. And Tuvok is just totally bothered by the fact that that fundamentally doesn't make sense. Like most human behavior and Betazoid behavior here, we're irrational creatures.
Yeah, I think the juxtaposition of this guy with these issues with Tuvok and obviously everything that we know about Vulcans and how they're this sort of sea of emotions underneath a layer of facade almost of calm. It's mm-hmm. just it's a great storyline. I love how they came up with that. I think it works incredibly well because there's a lot that they have in common, even though, well, I mean, we say that we wouldn't expect Tuvok ever to do anything like that, but, you know.
Well, he goes crazy.
He does go pretty, I mean, he almost strangles Neelix.
Oh, well.
Or he fakes strangles Neelix.
That, he should be given that. Everybody should get a chance to strangle Neelix when they need to.
That's his gimme, is it?
Yes.
I think this is one of the more interesting uses of the mind meld that we see, because both characters are really affected by the mind meld in a way that usually in Star Trek you get a mind meld and you can read each other's thoughts, then everyone kind of goes their separate corners and there's no like lasting effect. We really get to see that the mind meld itself could be a traumatic experience in this. Except in Enterprise.
In Next Gen, the episode Sarek, we see Picard having to deal with the aftermath of that.
But we don't see him taking on Sarek's qualities, although Spock says he has a Vulcan-like quality about him.
Yeah, it's interesting how we see, like you say, them both change, because the focus of the episode is more on Tuvok and the effect on him. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how quickly we suddenly see Suda showing much more calmness about him and a peace about him almost. And when Tuvok comes back a bit later on, he's there meditating. And
which the way Brad Dourif plays that is even creepier to me. It's like, whoa. It's like, I know you're still a psychopath, sociopath, whatever, but now you're creeping me out, dude.
But I think this really plays out in what you can consider to be the sequels of this episode, Basics 1 and 2, mm-hmm. when we see Suder really taking on the meditative, quiet, introspective qualities of Tuvok. Mm.
And manipulating orchids.
And he wants to grow orchids.
Yeah.
He can increase the output of the aeroponics bay. Come on, Captain Janeway, let him do it.
Well, she was going to think it over until he started getting a bit, whoa.
Got a little snippy with the captain there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to.
I love how that is played. I really love how that whole scene is played, and that little bit where he starts to lose it and he's just like, he doesn't properly shout or really properly lose his cool, but it's just, it's enough of an edge there, and mm-hmm. and the way that he just sort of coils his body and he sort of,
and his
you
eyes
just get
crinkle.
This sense of like, yeah, the danger in him, and then the way that Janeway like reacts, and you can almost see like this little tiny bit of fear. She almost like recoils from him, and you can almost see that she's like, whoa. So yeah, this guy really is that scary.
Do you guys sympathize with Suder at that point? Because even though he's scary, I do kind of sympathize with him. He wants to be useful.
Definitely.
And he wants to do something constructive. And he's frustrated. And I've had times in my life when I've just been pure frustrated at you know, the artificial constraints around me. And I'm not going to lose my cool like Suder, but, you know, there's this inner frustration. You can just feel the frustration building in him.
Oh, and you can see it on his face and in his posture. And it's just, it's palpable.
And it really is because he wants to do something good at that point. And that's tragic.
And she was preventing him from doing that. So that makes it even more frustrating. And you just want to scream.
Yeah. And one thing he said in that scene really struck me, actually. Well, it's not in that scene, actually, beg your pardon. It's in the earlier scene when he's talking to Tuvok. And he says, I never thought I had a talent for anything apart from killing. And he suddenly found that he's got this other thing that he can put his attention to. And it's like, Tuvok's given him enough clarity and enough calmness that he can actually focus on something other than that. Like, it's you then realize how much it's dominated his entire life.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like he's got a passion at this point, because at the beginning, when we first see him in Meld, you know, when Tuvok is questioning him, he basically says, yeah, I went into engineering and I was doing what I was doing, and the guy who got killed was doing what he was doing, and he wasn't really invested in anything. And you know, now he's got a passion. He wants to grow the orchids.
But I mean, it's just when you realize how it wasn't just a case of, oh, sometimes he got angry. It was like it was something that he was struggling to control all of the time. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you start asking yourself, well, if we're saying, oh, the guy's actually mentally ill, you know, he's not just a criminal who's like chosen to do something. At what point is it a case of, well, actually, how much can he be held responsible for what he's done if he's mentally ill?
It struck me that it was kind of like an addiction. Like, you know, he wants to not be that way and he wants to stop, but he can't. He's got these urges that he can't control. So he's going to go back to the bar one more time, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean, he obviously at first he doesn't really show any remorse. And when he's talking about the murder in Meld, mm-hmm. he's just really, really impassive about it. Like, there's no emotion. He's just being really matter of fact about what happened. But obviously once Tuvok's worked with him, you realise that there's another part of him under there that's trying to come out, that's been suppressed, that actually wants to be good and wants to do something useful and wants to be contributing to society. And it's just really sad, because it's like it's almost like he's got a split personality in a way.
Well, this puts Captain Janeway in a real difficult spot in terms of how to punish him, right? You know, there are only so many options. She can leave him in the brig, she can lock him in his quarters, she can try to rehabilitate him, or they can execute him. And, like, those are the four options.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see Tuvok kind of take the position that maybe they should consider executing him.
Yeah. Now, I'm just trying to remember. Does he say that after they've done the first meld? I think he does, doesn't he?
Yes, mm-hmm. That is after the first meld. Before he started going crazy himself.
Yeah, so I wonder whether or not that is actually supposed to be the first hint of the fact that there's something not quite right with him.
I could guarantee that would be the first hint, because that would not be something that a Vulcan or Tuvok would normally say.
I think Tuvok ordinarily would be more than willing to just let him sit in the brig the entire time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't quite sure why they couldn't stick him in the brig, at least for the short term. Because it's like, she says, oh, well, we can't leave him in the brig for 70 years or however long
it's
going
to be. In our dungeon, she calls it.
Yeah, but surely you could stick him in there at least for a while. Because, you know, if he'd been at home, he would have got some sort of prison sentence. But then I guess the prison that we see in Star Trek, it's not like the prisons that we think of now. Maybe they don't lock people up like that anymore.
He wouldn't have got a cush gig at the New Zealand prison. No. Like Tom.
It would have to be the 24th century of Supermax.
Well, this is interesting because when we talked about the penal colony last time, when we were talking about Tom Paris being there, we were talking about what prisons and sort of the penal system's like in the 24th century, and we don't see a lot of it. So we kind of have to go off what we can see, but there must be some more secure facilities or more secure areas within facilities, I guess.
I can actually kind of picture if Seven of Nine was on board at this point, which she wasn't, but if she was, she would have said, Punishment Protocol 9 Alpha.
She would have released some just sort of nanoprobes in them.
Yeah, they'd have fixed it with nanoprobes if Seven of Nine had been there.
We can rewire his brain. Here's some nanoprobes.
Yeah.
Nanoprobes or the brig? Neelix, you decide. Nanoprobes.
No, Neelix would be anti-nanoprobes because, remember, they brought him back from the dead and he was very upset about that.
Now, the other thing that I found really interesting as well was the fact that, as we already said, you know, he mentions that he kept this from, like, everybody that he knew, his family and friends and etc. Now, as somebody that lives in an entire society of Betazoids, how difficult must it be to keep stuff like that from people?
He's one closed-off dude if he can keep a secret from the rest of the Betazoids.
Either they knew, or he has had to expend a heck of a lot of mental energy trying to shield that off from everybody, which is an interesting thought in itself as well.
I mean, doesn't everyone have their kind of little inner box of secrets that they don't let out? I mean, everyone expends a little bit of energy being like that, don't they?
Well, yeah, but what I mean is, with the whole community of Betazoids around him and they're all telepathic, it's incredibly difficult to keep anything from anybody, presumably.
And possibly that might have aggravated his condition even more to a greater degree and made him even more sociopathic.
Exactly. If he's been forced to try and suppress it without really having the techniques to be able to do that in a healthy way, like he learns from Tuvok.
And Tuvok, he's just remarkably compassionate. Tuvok really, he doesn't expend too much energy on, he doesn't help Tom be a better person with meditation. He helps Kes out a little bit, right? But he doesn't go around saying, let me help you be a better version of yourself through meditation. We'll spend a lot of time doing it. Tuvok doesn't do that, but Tuvok takes Suter as his own little personal project.
Now, I had a flash of Tuvok as Dr. Phil there for a minute.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Hey, I can picture him like, Lon, get your act together, buddy.
Exactly.
See, that's a brilliant mental image, and I do really like that. But I wonder whether or not it's a bit more pragmatic than that, and it isn't just a case of, because he has this conversation with Janeway where it's like, oh, well, what are we going to do with him? And it's like, well, we haven't really got any good solutions. He kind of almost takes it on in a way of like, well, I need to try and do something to help him because we can't just leave him locked up in his quarters for 70 years when he's going gradually more bonkers.
I mean, given the options between keeping him in the brig forever and executing him, Tuvok is the one who takes it upon himself to find door number three and find a different path.
Yeah, I find it interesting, though, that after what happened early in the show with Creepy Dude's planet, whole Tuvok getting this, oh, he didn't go to Janeway, he kind of went behind her back and all this type of thing, that he would do that without saying anything to anybody, that he just went ahead and did it and didn't really think about any potential consequences. I found that quite interesting.
I can picture Captain Janeway, Tuvok, I thought we talked about this, buddy.
Yeah.
I think Tuvok had more confidence in his own abilities than he needed to have. He felt that he could control whatever came at him, and he was way wrong when it came to Suter.
Well, yeah, and then we see him be wrong with Kes as well, don't we, when he...
when she melts his brain.
You're kind of painting Mr. Tuvok out to be a bit overconfident and cocky, even.
He is a little bit.
I'm not sure it's cocky in that way, because I don't think that Vulcans really have cockiness as a thing.
But they have kind of
an
interior superiority complex, though, right?
No,
they
definitely do. Superiority complex.
We can keep it under control. Yeah,
it's not cockiness, humans though, can't. I don't think. Not in the way that we would think of it in humans.
Not outwardly, but like overconfidence, maybe.
Oh, yeah,
term.
They definitely think they're right. I mean, well, we see a lot of that in Enterprise, don't we? They think they're right all the time. Mm-hmm. And they're not always right all the time.
I actually just think it's really cute that Suter wants a job. Like, he wants something to do. He's stuck in his quarters and he wants to be useful.
He's
got this
bored.
Interesting orchids and aeroponics now. It can't just be boredom. I think, you know, if you were faced with being stuck in a room your entire life, you'd want to be useful again or do something.
It started with boredom, and then he found something that he enjoys, that he's passionate about, that he knows can help the crew. So, yeah, he's going to want to do that.
Is it like penance? Is he like trying to make up for the damage he's done to the crew? Like,
I think he's just trying to find his place. And once he's found that place, he's trying to embrace it and do it to the best of his abilities.
I'm not sure it's penance in quite that way. But for me, it definitely feels like he's suddenly found that he can do something that makes him feel useful, and he's not had that before. He just really wants to capitalize on that because it's this new feeling and it's positive, and he's not had a lot of positive feelings. So that's how I see it.
Yeah. Little orchid dopamine hit.
He's been sniffing too many flowers.
Well, that's kind of what we're talking about, right? I mean, he finally gets to feel good, and we all do. We do something productive, we reach an achievement, an accomplishment, we feel good about ourselves. That's what keeps us going.
Oh yeah,
and I think for him, you know, it's something that he's not just that, but that he's never realized he could have. It's probably stuff he's heard about other people saying, but he's just realizing what it feels like for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Kay, you're making me feel sorry for Alon Suter.
I do feel sorry for him.
So do I.
I do too. No, I really do. I was half joking.
The guy is mentally unwell, you know. I don't know how much we can hold him entirely responsible for what he's done. You know, he should be in some kind of psychiatric facility, as far as I'm concerned, getting help.
But he's still learning things to help deal with his illness. And possibly one day he might be well enough to interact with everyone freely.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think this is a very Star Trek view of crime and punishment in general. We've got someone who's admitted to the crime, he's willing to die for it, and they're going to find a more constructive path than that. That is so Star Trek. Mm-hmm.
When they're talking about him potentially being executed, and when he actually says, oh, I know what I'd do if I were Janeway, I'd execute me. It's almost like he wants it. It's like he wants that. He's like, he's almost begging for it.
Is it a challenge? Is it like throwing down the gauntlet?
He wants an end to the pain.
Yeah. I definitely feel that from him, yeah.
I like the challenge that he gives to Tuvok, though. He says, I'm ready to die, but are you ready to kill?
Mm.
That's a great challenge.
There are a whole bunch of incredible lines that he's given. The writing for him was great as well. I don't know whether having, you know, somebody so incredible on the show who's obviously going to run with it, they really sort of stepped up on the writing. But the stuff that they give him is amazing.
Any chance you get to bring Chucky on board?
Can't go wrong with Chucky.
Yeah, one line he said that I really liked was he said that life for him, it was like never knowing when he was going to get that impulse to be violent, and it was like living on the edge, but also attractive.
Mm-hmm.
You can just see from that quote that, you know, he's just walking this line between
attractive, like riding the ragged edge of disaster. Like what does that mean?
Well, I think it's just obviously he gets a lot out of the violence. You know, it's like a hit for him, like a drug addict.
A less positive dopamine hit than the orchid dopamine hit.
Yeah, because it is like that. You know, he definitely, I mean, I know you said it earlier, he's like an addict.
I think this is more like an addiction, yeah.
But also what is suggested as well from that is that underneath it all is this Suter that we see later.
Mm-hmm.
This Suter that he's enslaved to it almost. It's like he's watching himself do these things and he wants to stop, but he can't.
Doesn't it ring a little hollow, though, to say, you know, underneath all that exterior stuff, this monster is really a nice guy at heart? Doesn't that always ring a little hollow when you encounter the really horrible, evil people in the world? You go, wait a minute. Yeah, okay, he might be a nice guy at heart, but look at all these terrible things he did. He can't be that nice of a guy.
Well, yeah, but if he is mentally ill, as we've said, is he a monster? That's the real question.
Which addictions stem from mental illness?
Yeah, I think the addiction thing gives me more sympathy than he's an evil guy who's nice at heart.
I mean, I suppose we could start getting, you know, really into deep conversations about, well, actually, on some level, is everybody who could bring themselves to do stuff like that mentally ill and all the rest of it. But
this is To the Journey, and we're not that deep.
Yeah.
No. Really, though, I don't mean to go like all Metatrexy and deep on you guys, but I do think everyone's like this a little bit. We all have this interior monologue of good versus evil and doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing. And that means something totally different for everyone. But I think everyone can relate to this a little bit because we all have competing impulses.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like right now, I really have to resist the urge to like get up and get an ice cream because it's so hot in my house.
Is it because we were talking about ice cream before we started the show?
Are you going to have a 99?
A 99. I learned today for you listeners out there in the UK, I've learned what a 99 is. And if you're an American and you don't know what a 99 is,
you're missing
out. You can
out.
Email KA.
You can. You can email me or you can message me on Twitter and I will teach you about the ways of 99s.
Ask her about a double 99.
I have this funny story about Basics, which is that I didn't see Basics for a long time because I just kind of missed that episode. No, I'm serious. I watched the beginning of Voyager and then I stopped watching and then I picked up Voyager years later and just never watched Basics until years and years later. So I actually kind of had in mind that Lon Suter was still just like hanging out somewhere the entire run of Voyager, like in his quarters, in the brig, whatever. Like he was always there in the background.
I would have loved to have that character stay on. That would have been great, you know, occasionally popping up here and there.
In my head canon, for years, he was alive on the ship.
It would have been awesome, but I have to say, I do love what they do with him.
Old Black Eyes was down there in his quarters.
But it would have been great to see his possible reintegration with the crew.
To see him grow over time, and yeah, I agree. It would have been
showing that, yes, some mental illnesses can be conquered.
Yeah, he was too good of a character to kill off so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know whether they could afford to have him back again, though.
That's true. He's a pretty accomplished actor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to start talking about Basics, too, because I have this favorite quote of mine between the Doctor and Suter. Actually, it's just the Doctor talking and Suter's just standing there. But the Doctor's saying, you know, one hologram and one sociopath may not be much of a match for the Kazon, but we'll have to do.
Now, that quote makes so much sense with the Doctor. You know the Doctor loves being an underdog.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised he doesn't have, like, the emergency sociopath help.
He didn't think about making that program yet.
I think it's lovely, really, to see how much compassion we see the Doctor show for Suter. We see him treat him just like everybody else. And as we saw earlier, you know, Janeway's a bit scared of him. Janeway's a bit unsure about being in that proximity to him. But the Doctor's just sort of... I guess because, you know, he can't really hurt him.
He could decompile his program.
You could turn him off, right?
He could decompile him, yeah. But he can't hurt him in the way that he can hurt everybody else in this sort of violent way. So,
well, when Tuvok is channeling Suter after the mind meld, Tuvok basically says, you know, a few well-placed commands in the computer and your program's decompiled.
Yeah.
But I think the Doctor shows remarkable compassion for him. You're right. Mm-hmm. He basically says, I will help you get through this.
Yeah. Well, is that because the Doctor, as a doctor, with all the knowledge that he's got in his databanks, recognizes more the mental issues that he's got?
Oh, definitely.
I don't know. The Doctor does the same thing with the AMH Mark II, though, doesn't he, in Ship in a Bottle? He basically says, you know, get your act together. It's up to us. I'm not sure that's necessarily out of compassion. It might be, but the Doctor likes being a hero.
He does.
He does, but he's also incredibly motivational. Like, he does a good... line in motivational speeches.
He does. Yeah, he's like Tony Robbins, Dr. Tony Robbins. That should be the name he should pick.
Yeah.
He just likes to give speeches of any kind. Whether it's about the sperm attacking the ovum or whatever. Any chance he can get to
fortress ovum.
Yes, the
fortress ovum.
Gotta do the dance, Suzanne. I once saw an egg this big.
That's when they shrunk him. And he was riding around on the little mini train.
See, the Doctor could be like, okay, I got a plan. Miniaturize me and I'll go all Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and I'll get in the Kazon's ear.
Ew.
And I can picture like one of the Kazon screaming like, check off. Ah!
Oh, That little thing still creeps me out. I can't watch that.
Ugh. I don't know why I now have this mental image of the Doctor riding on a set eel. Riding along on this giant set eel.
Holographic earwigs.
They are awful, aren't they? Yeah, they're terrible, terrible things. I just really like, though, how... I know the Doctor can be incredibly sort of pompous, and we've talked about that before, and how he can sort of be very pretentious and full of himself, but I just love this side to him. I love this, like, genuine empathy and compassion he has for people. And we do see him show it to everyone at various different points. I mean, I know he likes to rib Tom Paris, but...
Who doesn't?
I think he really just genuinely cares about everyone.
I think by the end of Basics 2, everyone is really kind of compassionate and thankful, right? He sacrificed himself. You know, he kind of saved them. They appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I like the speaking of great quotes, they basically say, I hope you find the peace in death that you didn't find in life. That's a great quote.
That
I
is.
Think yeah. They've come to appreciate him, even given everything bad he's done.
Yeah, and even though... they've obviously come up with that for this episode. You can totally believe that that's something that Vulcans would have as a saying.
Mm. And just the Doctor letting Tuvok know you would have been proud of him.
Mm. Yeah, that's like the corollary to live long and prosper. It's like, live long and prosper. And if you don't, then may you find the peace and death that you didn't have in life.
Yeah. Peace and long life, or peace and death if you can't have the life part. That's like the street version.
The street version of live long and prosper. Yeah.
It's the slang.
But I really, when we see the Doctor sort of giving him that emotional speech and sort of motivating him and stuff, I love the scene we get from him there. And he doesn't say anything, because obviously at that point then he's by himself, because the Doctor's just sent him it via the message. And it's just the way that he sort of, he takes this deep breath and then he sort of rises in himself and he sort of takes his weapon and he sets off. And it's just, that is just an incredible piece of acting.
Now, he goes crazy shooting the Kazon and engineer. He shoots so many of them so fast, and I can't tell if he's enjoying it or if what's going on in his mind at that point.
I think it was just, he knew what he had to do and he had to do it quickly. So he didn't even think about it. It just...
lots and lots of dopamine.
He sniffed a bunch of orchids and then he went down there.
He sniffed his orchids and went down there.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what you said there, actually, Suzanne. Because to me, how it felt was he's trying not to think about what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Because if he thinks about what he's doing, he's going to lose the plot.
Yeah.
That's how I read that. There's this odd sense of sort of coiled desperation about him. Like he's trying to suppress what he's feeling as a result of what he's having to do. Because we get the bit earlier on as well when he's killed the Kazon that he's dragged back in the Jeffries tube wherever he killed him. And the way he reacts then is just incredibly. He sort of falls on the floor, like, helplessly. Like, he's just totally overcome with the feelings of it.
Poor little sociopath.
I still wish he could have lived.
Oh, no, I he's a great character. And, you know, it's so funny because I actually kind of had to remind myself that he's only in 3 episodes. Mm-hmm. And I just, he was made such a strong impression on me. I'm like, wow, only 3 episodes? Really? Before we recorded today, this week, I went and Googled it. Like, how many episodes was Lon Suter in? Oh, 3? That's it? I just thought it was more.
He's just, it's powerful. Powerful performance.
Hmm. Obviously, we remember the one where he first shows up and then in Basics what happens then. But yeah, I agree. I just had it in my head that there was like a couple of other episodes in between where he sort of pops up and there
is. Well, he is mentioned. He's mentioned in Counterpoint as one of the casualties, the telepathic casualties, which he's the only
one.
And you guys would know this more than I do since you guys are more into reading novels than I am. I just don't have time to do that these days. But does he come up in any of the Voyager novels regularly?
I know he's been in a novel. Oh, man.
Not in the Voyager
Not in the Voyager reboot ones, but it's another one.
I mean, it's possible that he's mentioned. I don't remember him being mentioned. He certainly doesn't feature heavily in the Voyager relaunch ones.
Well, he's dead, right? So,
but he could have been mentioned. I mean, they talk about a heck of a lot of characters in those books, and they invent a lot of new characters as well. So, but yeah, it would be interesting if there was a book that told us more about his past before Voyager.
That would be a great novel.
Actually, I think it's his mirror universe.
Oh, is he good? Oh,
really? Is a mirror universe Lon Suter?
Is he like super benevolent and just goes around giving money to people?
He was a member of the Terran Rebellion.
Giving out ice cream and kissing puppies.
He always had the gardening thing going on.
Awesome. Which book is that?
Mirror Universe novel, Rise Like Lions.
It would be interesting if he shows up in any of the other books that mention Beta Zed before Voyager, because there are a number.
Wouldn't this be a great one-off novel, just the backstory of one?
Yeah. Oh, it'd be awesome. Especially if they could have Brad Dourif do the audio version.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Someone has to make that happen. That needs to happen, definitely.
Yeah, we need to start a petition for that. So, other favourite little moments then. I really like the bit where, after he's kind of had this disappointment with Janeway, he's reacted badly to Janeway, and then you can see that he's disappointed in himself. Mm-hmm. When Neelix comes in with his food and he's just sitting there, and you get his profile with it like lit up with the pale lights from behind him, that is so creepy.
Yeah.
I love that scene. It's just so tense. And Neelix is like, I brought you some Liana Root stew. And he just says, I'm not hungry. Like, really deadpan. And Neelix is like, okay, I'm just going to leave it over here and back away slowly.
Who would be hungry for that? Nobody.
Those are some of my favorite moments in general, when the cinematography and the music all comes together to set a mood. You know exactly what's going on and no one's saying anything. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Some of the very best moments are the impressions that you're given of people acting without actually using any words. Definitely.
And some actors can do that. Like, some actors can do that better than others.
Mm-hmm. It's just a natural talent. You either have it or you don't have it.
Like, I'm actually rewatching the original Dallas right now to point out again how old I am.
You're so old.
Yeah, and like Larry Hagman's character, J.R. Ewing on Dallas, just drips irony, right? You don't believe a word he says. He doesn't have to say anything. You know he's scheming. All you have to do is look at his face. And Lon Suter's kind of like that, right? You just look at him and you can kind of peer into his mind, even though he's not saying anything.
Just stare into those black eyes.
Stare into those big black
dead
eyes.
Dead eyes. It's like a doll's eyes. And then they roll over white. Oh, sorry. I'm quoting Jaws now.
Now, I had heard. Now, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know this, and I never noticed before, but I had heard that Betazoids always had black eyes, and we just never noticed until Lon Suter. Now, I find that incredible that I never noticed that before. Is that true?
Liana Troi has black eyes. Loxana Troi has black
eyes. I never noticed
eyes.
That fact. But did she continue into the movies? You know, when we see the close-ups of her in when she's tossing back drinks with Zefram Cochrane, does she have the black eyes?
Well, her eyes
there?
Are a little red at that point because she's had too much tequila.
Her eyes are a little bloodshot at that
tequila,
point.
Tequila, it makes me happy.
So even then, so it's the entire time and I've just literally never noticed this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why does it stand out so much with Lon Suter?
Because they do so many close-ups of his face. Mm-hmm. And so many close-ups of his eyes.
Just to give him that creepier look. And the lighting on his face was always stark.
Mm.
Whereas the lighting for Luoxana and Deanna was very soft and flattering.
Yeah, and he's incredibly kind of pasty. And the makeup that they've used on him, you know, he's very...
Pale face.
Yeah.
Is Lon Suter creepier than Pleasure Dude?
Yes.
Different kind of creepy. Pleasure Dude, you don't want him following you home. Lon Suter, you don't want to walk into your apartment and turn on the lights and he's there. That kind of creepy.
Yeah. Got it.
But I just... I love his arc. And I know we've said that it would have been great to see him longer and to be able to see him grow more and potentially get back to or get a normal life or a more normal life than what he's had. But I do like the arc that he has. I think it's very fitting. And I just love the fact that he really doubts himself when he realizes that he's going to have to use violence and that there's times when he has to use it, and he doubts his ability to come back from that. And yet when the doctor says to him, you know, oh, the fate of the ship rests with you, it's you that's going to have to do it, you know, he rises to the challenge. He rises to that and he succeeds. And I just think that's... Mm-hmm. I love that. I really like that.
Well, he's got himself wrapped in a tight little knot. He knows he's not a great person at heart in some ways, and he doesn't trust himself. He has no confidence. So he's really got himself wrapped up in his own headspace.
But it is great to see him. And it feels like he's redeemed himself, almost like he dies a hero, you know.
Yeah. And definitely he dies a hero. Because without him, they couldn't have retaken the ship, and they all would have died on that planet whose name I can never remember, eaten by the giant worm creature.
It's like the end of Braveheart when Mel Gibson yells, "Freedom!"
But his face wasn't painted half blue, so he can't do that.
No, that's true.
And he wasn't wearing a kilt.
But imagine how much his big black eyes would have popped if he was wearing the blue face paint.
That is true.
Like a bullion. I didn't realize the bullions were Scottish, but you know.
Bullions could be Scottish. We'll have to ask Lee about that.
Like, remember that episode of The Next Generation where there's like all these aliens that have taken on this Scottish identity and this on Sub Rosa, in the episode Sub Rosa, remember?
Ah, yeah.
We just like the Highlands, so we decided to become Scottish. So I guess I do have one other kind of last thought on Lawn Suitor. If Lawn Suitor did exist for a couple more episodes, what kind of story would we tell to get Lawn Suitor back in the game on Voyager? Ooh. Like, what are those two or three missing episodes that we thought were there that really aren't?
I mean, we'd have to see him sort of struggling back and forth between being able to function and not being able to function because, you know, it's not going to be easy for him. He's not just, it's, yes, this has suddenly given him a measure of clarity he hasn't had before, but it's not something that's going to suddenly make him magically better. So we definitely want to see him probably having to get involved in some sort of crisis. And then, because assuming this episode hadn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like basics, right? He gets involved in a crisis.
Yeah, but that wouldn't have happened, presumably, if we were going to keep him in there because...
Well, no, you could still, die you could end, still have it? That, but not have him die at the end.
Okay. Yeah, you could do that. So then, from there, they'd probably then end up with another interesting dilemma of, well, what do we do with him now? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess we'd see Janeway giving him permission to do his... Aeroponics research.
Yeah.
Yeah. If he gets on parole, like if he's done, you know.
Yeah.
That's the missing episode. Lawn Suitor on parole.
Well, yeah, and then we could see him go and do his aeroponics research, and then that would obviously mean him having a lot more contact with Kes.
Does that make Tuvok his parole officer?
Which that would have been a great dynamic, having him interact with Kes.
Yeah, and then as the Kes and Tuvok thing progresses, he could be involved in that. Mm-hmm. There could be an involvement in there. As well, so that could potentially be very interesting. Also, we could have some kind of aeroponics vegetable overgrowing sentience type caper, which would be very entertaining.
Like they would totally be like gardening together in aeroponics. And Kes is
Attack
already dripping
of the
with
killer
compassion
tomato.
Anyway, right?
Some type of entertaining caper involving the aeroponics bay. That is what I would like to see.
I can actually really picture them becoming close friends. Like they both like aeroponics. Kes is already dripping with compassion. You know, she would lay that on thick and she would be there to, you know, support him and help him.
She
That's
would
what Kes
definitely
does.
Be supportive of him. And
yeah, so they would have these like, you know, bonding moments down there together in aeroponics. Yeah. Totally.
And then Neelix would get jealous.
Yes. And then Neelix would throw spaghetti at him.
No, and Lawn Suitor would, like, glare at Neelix with those big black eyes with intensity. Like, you can see the intensity building, but aimed at Neelix.
Yeah. Wow.
That's my basics rewrite.
No, it is fun. It's really fun to think about. Because, like we've said, you know, we would like to have seen him stay in there more. And it's fun to think about how that would have panned out.
Yeah, instead of Kes having fury, it would totally be Lawn Suitor. Lawn Suitor's walking down the corridor and things are blowing up behind him. Boom, boom, boom.
I don't think he has those powers.
Kes can give him the power. She can share the power.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking about Lawn Suitor today, but this is not the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Melodic Treks.
You know, the way it slowly builds and then just crescendos and ends with an explosion. Anytime a movie starts with something exploding, you know you're going to be in for a good time. I mean, I'm really kind of obsessed with the way movies start.
Literary Treks.
McCoy eventually gets command of the Enterprise, and one of the reasons for this is that he makes little comments to Kirk occasionally about how he has a cushy job. You know, he's got, this nice, comfortable chair he can sit in. Because McCoy, at this point, he's got a lot of people getting sick on the Enterprise. There's colds, there's broken legs or whatever. I mean, there's just, for some reason, sick bay is busy.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
the thing that finally pushed me over the edge. This is going to sound so stupid. I've said this before. They were releasing a Superman versus Aliens comic book. And I was like, oh, I guess I better get ready for Superman versus Aliens and watch, you know, the Alien movies.
The Ready Room.
Every major turn in Star Trek history has been an adjustment to get used to it. Even going into motion picture when all people had done for 10 years was pray to their savior gene to get a show back, to get it back. And even with all the changes and even the canon explanation for the changes, it was still a big change.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You will find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you are not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can also stream and download the MP3 file from our website, or you can grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose message to a Trek FM show and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. So Kay, if our listeners would like to talk to you about how you shaved off your eyebrows to look even creepier in Lord of the Rings, how can they contact you?
Well, they can find me in the Babel Conference. And if they want to look me up on Twitter, my handle is Choco Weeble. Also, if they would like to hear me elsewhere on Trek FM, I hosted the recent Patrons Roundtable where we talked about women in Star Trek. That was a lot of fun, so check that out. Zach, when you're not over in the Mirror Universe handing out ice cream and kissing puppies, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of Metatrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and Voyager with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Suzanne, when you're not lost in those big Betazoid eyes, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
You can find me popping up here and there in the Babel Conference. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is KJaneWay8.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more. All available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd like to take this moment to thank some very special people. First being C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Richard Marquez, our production manager. And Brandon Shematala, our Patreon manager. We also have some extra special people, our associate producers, Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, and Richard Marquez. Thank you!
So join us next week when we will be reenacting Attack of the Killer Tomatoes in the Airponics Bay. But until then, this has been To the Journey.